dude, this is not subtle.
Hello and welcome to The Dirt. I'm Tim Wright, and today I'm here with Steve Hickey.
Morning, Tim.
Morning, Steve. And I'm also here with special guests Liza Kindred and Josh Clark. Liza is the founder and editor-in-chief at Third Wave Fashion, and Josh is the founder of Big Medium. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Well, hello there.
Thanks for coming on, and congratulations on getting married.
Woohoo!
Yeah. First ever podcast as a married couple. I don't know if you guys can tell, we are filled with happiness and joy up in here.
Well, we're happy to be a landmark episode in your life. This is a very important day for the both of you.
And this is our first episode with a married couple, too.
Well, so. All right.
Well, we heard that that The Dirt needed some happiness and joy.
That is unfortunately accurate. So this is part of a series we're doing on future design, and we've done, you know, a few different series. We did one on, you know, designing with NASA and fictional UI and future accessibility. And we wanted to have Josh and Liza on the show because we wanted to talk about the future of wearable tech. And it's kind of like, you know, we're starting this evolution back into the physical world where, you know, you walk into a restaurant now and everybody has their faces jammed into their phones, and the wearables are kind of pulling us out of that. I feel like, you know, we're not being so into our devices. They're more secondary, and we're allowing ourselves to live life a little bit more. I wonder what do you guys think of where we're going with this stuff?
I mean, I think that's ideal. I hope we're moving in the direction of what you're describing. And I see that happening sometimes. Some of my fear about wearables is that they're actually going to make some of that stuff worse. For instance, with a lot of the notifications wearables and the smartwatches, when you get a notification, it actually is kind of directing you to look at your device. And so it's kind of adding a second step there. But I'm hoping that it will actually, we're able to filter through some of that mess and move in the direction of connecting with each other on a more meaningful basis.
I think just to add on that there is this opportunity to sort of make it so that the information comes to us instead of us constantly having to dive into the information. But as Liza said, a lot of the defaults for these sort of notification systems are turned up way too high.
So it's like, do you guys remember the Tamagotchis?
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, that craze. I don't know, it was in the 90s, and it was those little, like, it was just like a little tiny electronic device that was like, beep, beep, water me, beep, yeah, beep, feed me, beep, beep, look at me. The first time I put on a smartwatch, it was the first iteration of the Pebble, and I was like, oh no, I've got a Tamagotchi on my wrist. And it really felt like, oh, it needed some care and feeding, or it was going to die. It needed a lot of attention, you know. And I feel like that was kind of version one. And I'm hoping that our Tamagotchis maybe will become a little bit more independent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, no, it's a great thing. It's a perfect metaphor, because the idea is that technology should be working for us, not us working for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just took the Apple Watch for a spin for a week. Our CEO bought one so everyone in the office could give it a try. And that the notifications were the absolute most disruptive part of it. I mean, I solved that problem for myself a while ago by simply turning off all the notifications,
right,
something which tends to horrify people when I tell them that. And to actually try the watch out accurately, I had to turn them all back on. And it's been a hellish week, to be honest.
What in particular has been hellish about it? The interruptions or?
Yeah, it's just I've gotten really used to not getting those interruptions and being able to actually focus on my work. And you know, there were some pieces of it that were more
convenient. Stop talking right now and stand up. Stand up.
Yeah, exactly.
Stand up.
Or I was at a movie the other night and a bunch of people started emailing back and forth at 9 p.m., and just like every couple of minutes, the watch lit up. I had to turn it off.
Oh, the group things are the worst. I love my family dearly, but I had to ask them to take me out of the group messages because it's just, it's crazy the frequency that stuff can happen. Like, I definitely want to see pictures of cute kids, but,
just,
you know, not while I'm in the middle.
Want to.
Yeah, yeah, my own time.
Well, I mean, so as a design principle, I would say that we have kind of embraced this idea that engagement is the number one goal, and that one of those things is, you know, engage with me, engage with me, engage with me. And, you know, I think that for those of us who've been designing mobile interfaces and now this new generation of wearable things, I think the real question is has that been the wrong goal all along? Have we actually been doing a disservice? And perhaps we should be thinking less about how can we get somebody to engage and really sort of thinking about how can we give them just enough information at just the right time and then get the hell out of the way.
Yeah, I think a lot of people never bother to ask the question, like, is what I'm building actually worth annoying somebody constantly with? Like, what will this add to their lives if I am assaulting them with information all the time?
And I think also making it easy for people to make those decisions on their own. So they can kind of decide, yes, I want to be interrupted by the babysitter. No, I don't want to be interrupted by the boss or whatever that is. And I think also it's a little bit about changing the conversation around what engagement actually means. Mm-hmm. Because for a long time when we were talking about measuring things in terms of engagement, we were talking about digital engagement and keeping people's eyeballs there. And I think what Josh is kind of talking about is flipping that on its head and thinking of engagement as something we're allowing for people to do in their offline lives. Mm-hmm. So maybe the measure of engagement is exactly the opposite of what we thought it was. It, like he's saying, it's allowing people to spend as little time as possible engaged with our products so that people can go back to actually living their lives offline.
Right. And it's like going beyond the how do I get someone to use this because I have to get them to use it into how do I make this product actually enrich their life, even if that means, you know, knowing when to notify them, but also knowing when to not notify them.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of it means how can we push that engagement, as Liza was saying, into the actual physical world so that it's not about screens. I think, you know, that's one of the big opportunities for this idea of Internet of Things, of embedding smarts in regular everyday objects and places, is that, you know, instead of being inspired by your environment and then going to a screen to sort of learn more about it or whatever, that you can actually interact with the environment itself, that the interface becomes the physical world rather than these little screens we carry around.
And this there's a lot of stuff that's not working with the wearables. Primarily, you know, feels like it's the notifications that have to be fine tuned. And that's, you know, that's the things like, you know, watches and I guess maybe if Fitbits or, but we also have glasses, tattoos, ingestibles. There's a lot of different sort of, I guess, what you would call wearables. Would you all call something like an ingestible a wearable tech?
That's an awesome question. I was actually having a conversation with somebody about that yesterday who was asking me to define what wearables means to me. And me personally, I kind of draw the line at injectables and ingestibles, mostly because I don't have a true understanding of how they work from a biology perspective. And so it's not something I feel like I can necessarily advise people on from a practical standpoint. But those kinds of things, any part of the Internet of Things, any kind of connected devices from out in our homes and our cars, kind of moving all the way into things we wear on our bodies to things we may put in our bodies as well, they all need to follow the same kind of principles, the same value system, which is what Josh and I are working on in the book that we're authoring right now, is putting together practical advice based on a value system we think that people should follow to help us build these kind of crazy futuristic things in a way that makes our future one that we all want to live in.
Mm-hmm. Well, can we talk about that value system or you want to hold, we want to hold it off for the book?
Now let's talk about it. We have so much to say.
Great.
Yeah.
So, so what sort of things, you know, should we, I guess, is it like a should we, shouldn't we sort of a thing?
You know, I mean, I think that it all comes down to should we, shouldn't we? It's this idea that we're about to make a real change in the way that we interact with information. We're beginning to see that now where, you know, we're embedding sensors and computers and connectivity all around us. And all of a sudden, that's a really different kind of proposition than interacting very specifically and in limited stretches with real intention through screens. And so as we're creating this new world, it's really important that we get the values right because it really shapes our assumptions going forward in the same way that Google has shaped assumptions by saying, hey, you can have all this stuff for free if we can do everything with all of your data. All of your data. And there's now this sort of assumption. It's like, oh, that's just the way that things work. So, you know, I think that cooking the right values into this moment and sort of saying, you know, why are we doing what we're doing and what are we doing with data is important. So, you know, it's the kinds of basically the book that we've just begun to write is organized around a structure of these different values. And, you know, I think one of the big ones and sort of an overarching one is this idea of designing for humans. That, it, you know, it's instead of leading with technology, instead of saying, here's a technology, you know, here's for Google Glass, here's, you know, I've got a camera and a little computer. What if I put it on your face? you know, that's a technology question. Instead of saying, what if these glasses were magic? What if these glasses were more of what they could do? What if these glasses, you know, could fit a more sort of specific human need? It's a subtle shift, but it's something that's focused on our lives and the tenor of our lives. But I think also, particularly to go back to what you were asking about with wearables, is, you know, there's something specific about wearables, which is that they're also fashion and outward facing. And I think that,
well, they're supposed to be fashion,
well,
right?
That's the opportunity. Yeah.
I mean, I think that the market for people who want to look like androids or cyborgs is really, really small. and unfortunately, we continue to design devices for this like imagined group of people that want to like strap screens on the outsides of their bodies. And in fact, I think that that's one of the mistakes that we're making, is we're thinking often as of wearables as things that have screens on them or interact with things that have screens on them. And there is an enormous potential there for things like smart materials or things that you don't actually have to interact with a screen kind of at any point along the way, that can kind of be autonomous in different ways. And so I think we need to kind of stop focusing on screens. They are important, and obviously they're a good kind of hack for interaction with wearable devices, but they're not the only thing that's out there, and they're not necessarily what we need to be designing our devices on in the near future either.
When you start thinking about behavior, I think it's when you start to unlock some really interesting potential. Like one of the items I found in the copy of your magazine that you shared with me was something called the Ruby. It's a button.
Right.
And it's like, it's basically like a bailout button. You put it in your shoes, and if you click your heels together 3 times to press the button, it can send you a phone call, so you can use that as an excuse to get out of a really uncomfortable situation.
Or send you a car.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
Whatever it is. Yeah. I mean, part of what I like about that is that it's just a little device that you can program to do whatever it is that you want it to do, which I think gives a lot of power back to people to be able to kind of decide for themselves what kind of, you know, you're talking about behavior. They want to talk, people can decide for themselves what kind of behavior and interactions they want to be having with products.
You know, people have all these habits and behaviors built in, and with some careful observation, you can actually sort of enhance those things instead of just screaming, okay, I've got a bunch of glass and some pixels, now you have to do it this way.
Right, or do something entirely different, you know, learn this new gesture language or something like that, because that's how my device works. So start, you know, snapping your fingers for this reason or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we create physical interactions and physical interfaces for digital systems, you know, we've got centuries of experience for how those objects work. And also even sort of going beyond that, centuries of experience of like myth and legend, of the stories we've been telling ourselves of what if these shoes were magic. You know, I mean, it's straight out of Wizard of Oz, right? It's like we already have design patterns in place for how to do this stuff, that we don't have to create new arcane ways to use these, to build from the object out. That's another one of our principles, is like designing for a thing's essential thingness. It's not about transforming it into something completely different from what it was before. How do you make a thing more of what it was? And sometimes that's really mundane. Sometimes that's really small, little incremental improvements. But, you know, in aggregate, it's something that adds up to a lot.
And sometimes it's a magic wand. I have to tell you, Josh has a magic wand. Whoa,
she's
hey, slow down. he's actually programmed our Sonos, our in-house audio system, to work with his magic wand so that he can switch tracks and switch the volume and things like that using a magic wand. And it's just kind of funny to think about the ways we can apply that in our daily lives. I mean, it's just a little thing, right? But it's a good party trick.
Well, we were actually working on a project a couple of years ago. It was a game that unfortunately never made it to market. It was just too hard to get the right equation for funding. And it was literally a Bluetooth magic wand that connected to your phone. And then you ran around out in the real world being a wizard.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there was way more complexity to it. But describing the system was so interesting, because the initial reaction I would get from a room full of people was, that's insane. And then when I finished describing it, it was, okay, how long till I can buy that?
Right.
You bring up an interesting point, though, that, you know, it kind of comes back to the smartwatch and what is it good for. You know, as we start to add more and more of devices, whether they're, you know, Bluetooth magic wands or smartwatches, more sort of like small little elements into our personal ecosystem, they can begin to talk to each other and affect each other. So, you know, right now the smartwatches are pretty much used just to skim the surface of information from your phone, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of like notifications, just the top level information from your phone. And we're starting to also see experiments with it going the other way, which is how can you kind of skim the top level of interaction with your phone? So I just wrapped up a little bit of work with a startup called Presto. That's Presto is an app for Android Wear, and it's basically it lets you do gesture. So they've done this really incredible work of being able to detect if they're, you know, when you snap your fingers or flick your fingers or raise your hand or flip your hand in and out, so that you can actually. So we created this gesture system for what these things mean. And what it means is that you can actually, like, you know, sort of one of the early, this very first app that we've got, it's really sort of a novelty app sort of to generate interest in this idea of using gesture with your watch. But when you're wearing the Android Wear watch, you can control the sound and music on your Android phone, which is super satisfying to just snap your fingers to get, like, a sound effect to play and to sort of increase the intensity of the sound by raising your hand up and down. And it does sort of create this wizardry that it's that's possible just because we've begun to sort of sprinkle smart gadgets all in every aspect of our life.
There's a product I pre-ordered a couple of years ago, and
are you still waiting for it?
Yeah, exactly.
is it Lockatron?
Nope, it was the.
I'm still waiting for my Lockatron.
Of course. It was the Mayo armband.
Oh, which.
It, like, detected the muscle twitches in your arm through the electrical signals, and then you could configure it to do different things, like if you snapped your fingers or if you flicked in a specific direction. I thought that would be awesome because at the time I was just getting started with speaking, and I thought, oh, I could be up on stage and, like, waving my arm around to move the slides and having stuff actually happen. And I don't know. In retrospect, that might have been a silly idea, but at the time, the idea, it just seemed so cool. Like, there were so many different applications for it. Like, I could control music or presentations, or you could use it in video gaming and things like that. And you could actually use real gestures to do stuff that seemed like a physical mimicking of another action, and it would create an effect. I'm so pissed that it still isn't available.
Yeah, and by the way, that they're out. That product is out, so you better hunt yours down.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. but I think you're touching on something that's really interesting, which is when we're actually, our bodies are able to become these physical avatars of our digital selves is when it becomes, I think, really interesting and really compelling. And one of the values that we're writing about in the book is actually helping people to be more human, to be more of who we are and not less of who we are, and to not actually turn into robots, but to actually be able to do cool things with ourselves. And there's interesting things like with the Motorola password pill. You swallow the pill and it becomes your password for the day as you walk around. It unlocks your phone, your car, your house, or whatever. And what I find particularly compelling about that is that you're actually becoming who you are. So you're becoming more of yourself. You just are you, and you're proving it by being you. And I think that is really interesting. And there is a little bit of augmentation going on, but you're actually representing yourself and who you are, which is awesome. It's like you being you.
So maybe you
should
have
taken the blue pill.
Maybe if you had to have a phrase for all that stuff, it's less wearable tech and more humanist tech or something.
Yeah, exactly. And to take a little bit more pragmatic approach, Josh loves to talk about things being magic, and he has a lot of really great examples of that. But I'm finding that when I'm working with fashion brands, particularly, I work with a number of fashion brands and technology companies and kind of help them try to work together. And one of the things I'm trying to help fashion brands understand is that we're moving into a world where we want our things to function for us, and not just electronics, but actually the devices, or not devices, but the things that we're wearing. So accessories we're wearing, or clothes we're wearing, or bags we're carrying. We're getting to this point where we want them to do something for us. So I personally, my head is in this all the time, and I see something now. I see a beautiful necklace or something, and I think, okay, that's great, but what does it do? You know, I want something to actually function for me. There's beautiful handbags, and I love them, and I collect them. But now I'm like, why would I want a handbag that can't keep my devices charged? You know, and at a certain point, I'm going to think, why do I want a handbag that isn't its own, you know, wireless hotspot? And so we're kind of adding these layers of function. And maybe that's magic. But for me, it is just a little bit more of practical functionality into the things that we're already buying and wearing.
And at the same time, you know, it also goes the other way, that as we have these functional things, they should also be beautiful. You know, it's like I should want to carry this handbag, or maybe Liza would rather carry the handbag, that you know, whether it has technology in it or not, it should be something that is expressive.
That is
so
beautiful.
It goes
yeah.
both ways.
Yeah, anything that you choose that other people will see on you is really, you're choosing a reflection of your personality, which I think is what makes it into fashion more so.
It's true,
technology.
Yeah, yeah. And it's why, you know, so many people didn't want to wear a Google Glass because that's...
It looked silly as hell.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think part of that, too, is a little bit of a problem with early adoption because mm-hmm. the people that were wearing them were, like, not it.
It killed the cool factor immediately.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. You said it.
I was talking with someone who was on the original Glass team, and they went, as you might imagine, through a bunch of different prototypes. Mm-hmm. And they wound up, of course, where they are is this very kind of insular, I have my own private world that, you know, I'm looking at data and recording you in ways that you don't understand. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the only thing they looked at. You know, one of the iterations that they had was the extrovert glass, mm-hmm. where it's like, it was basically a little projector on the glasses that could project what was on my phone, what I'm seeing. So it was actually flipped it around. It wasn't keeping this private information behind my, you know, opaque, inscrutable glasses. It was sharing the information out of it, shared vision.
I wonder if people would accept that more simply because it feels less like you're hiding something or being secretive.
Well, it is a different set of values, right? So I think that sort of come back with this idea of sort of values and design principles that Liza and I are talking about. I think that it's not an. I think that there's a. This is a rich moment of experimentation when we should be trying out stuff just mm-hmm. to see what we can do. But especially when we take things to market, especially when we expose it to the public and get out of our laboratories, I think it's just really important to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? How will it be used? How mm-hmm. will it mm-hmm. affect the fabric of our lives? And I think, you know, just talking about this, you know, and as Liza's saying, well, why wouldn't I want a necklace that can do something? Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's some people out there who are wigged out by that, who are like, I got enough digital stuff in our lives. And I think that there is a certain amount of anxiety that you run into with people when you talk about the smart home or, you know, wiring things up and, you know, Amazon Echo, listening to everything that you're saying so that mm-hmm. you can order something. You know, it gets spooky. And I think that part of this is this sense of a loss of agency.
Yeah.
That's our fear with these things, that the machines are going to make a bad decision. And I think, you know, one of these other principles that we have is the idea to honor intention, but don't assume it. Mm-hmm. Algorithms aren't that good. And one of Liza's, you know, one of your things that you say that I love is this idea that my hand on the doorknob should override the smart lock. You know, it's like, sometimes the systems need to get out of the way, and sort of human intelligence is a great thing to put in when...
Or even non-intelligence, right? Like, if I shouldn't open the door, but I decide I want to, I should still be able to open the door, you know? I mean, the human aspect of things should always be able to override the kind of artificial intelligence, right? I mean, Josh keeps talking about human intelligence being, you know, the top... we're not always the smartest, but we are the humans, you know? So we should be able to make the decisions about stuff. And that's part of the reason this the skepticism and this fear... We see it all the time, and it's part of the reason why I think it's so important for us as designers and developers of this new world of connected devices and wearable technologies. We have to have these kind of overarching value systems that Josh and I are writing about so that we're making decisions that will let people trust us.
Yeah.
And make the world not just a better place, you know, for us, but for everyone that's using this stuff. And I think that divulging of information about what's going into a product and what, you know, what data is being collected, that kind of stuff is essential for us.
You have that great metaphor, Liza, about the nutrition label.
Yeah, I really think that disclosure is so important. Information is important. We live in New York City, and one of the things that New York City has done recently is they actually require calorie counts to be on menus. Mm-hmm. And it's they're not limiting calorie counts. They're just asking for information. And it's crazy because, first of all, I learned I was wrong about some foods that had higher calories and lower calories. Mm-hmm. For instance, Rice Krispie treats are apparently very good for you.
it's our new health food, really.
Yeah, yeah, basically carrots. but it's just kind of putting that information out there. So the mm-hmm. calorie counts are just on the menus, and people are allowed to make their own decisions. And I feel like that kind of thing is really important when we're looking at the kind of data that we're collecting with connected devices or just the kind of technologies that are going into them. And I would love to see something like a nutrition label that goes on devices that just says, listen, this is what this device does. This is what this device is learning about you. This is how you can change change it or stop it, and just making it really simple, easy to parse information so that people can make decisions on their own. Because listen, I mean, Josh and I do this stuff full time and we can't keep up. There's no one out there that kind of has an understanding of like every single device and what everything is doing. And so I think we need to have some kind of way that we're collecting and aggregating and presenting that information to people so that they can make smart, intelligent decisions.
Yeah, it goes in hand with the terms of service agreement problem, that if you actually read all of the terms of service you'd agreed to in your lifetime, it would actually take something like 10 years. So obviously no one's doing it. It's like,
and you would never agree to what's in those terms of service, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I highly recommend reading Google's terms of service.
Oh, God, I don't even want to know.
The stuff that you are allowing them to do with your content. You own it, but they can do anything they want with it.
Yeah, was it the Samsung smart TVs? They had a warning in the latest version of them that you shouldn't talk about sensitive stuff in front of your television because they can hear you. And it's like paragraph for paragraph. It's like a chapter of 1984 basically transposed into legalese.
And we should be scared.
Yeah.
That is scary. That's crazy, you know?
Or we have an Amazon Echo in our office, and we spent the entire first day it was in here just saying silly things to it because we realized whenever you called it to attention, it was recording what you asked it, whether it understood it or not, and putting it into the app. So we loaded up our boss's app with a bunch of ridiculous phrases for him to find later. But like, how hard is it to just turn that thing around and be like, hey, tell you what, just listen all the time without the blue light?
Well,
and see what happens.
I think that's the thing. It's like, is what's happening with the data? I mean, it's unsettling to think that it's like, oh, a giant corporation is now recording everything that I'm saying. But but it just touches on a broader thing that, particularly when we have these free services, there's just this real sort of disquiet of who does this service benefit? Who's the ultimate beneficiary of it? Is it me, the end user, or is it the company on the other side? And I think particularly for services where their business model is not completely in line with what they're offering their user, Amazon is actually pretty aligned, right? It's like, it's a pretty direct, you're buying stuff, we're selling. Apple is pretty direct too, we're buying products, you're selling. Google's is not, right?
Yeah.
Google's
or
is
Facebook's.
Like, that's right.
Yeah.
The data-driven companies or ad-driven companies, media companies, that's where things start to get tricky because their business interests don't align with their users' interests.
Yeah, I think working in tech, that feels really obvious to us, but I had this moment at a family holiday recently where I said to somebody, like, think about it. If Facebook and Google are free, then you're not actually the customer. So who is the customer and what are they getting from it? And it was like, for people outside of tech, that's sort of a mind-blowing thought. Like, wait a minute, this isn't about us. No, you're the product now.
Right. That's tough for people to understand. But I also think that, I mean, that kind of stuff is intentionally obscured by companies, for better or for worse. And I really do feel like as we're moving into people's bodies, we have to be more transparent about that kind of stuff. And I think it also really speaks to this idea that we have new and different business models that are going to change the patterns of what's happening in our lives. I'm actually finishing my first book right now, which is for O'Reilly. It's about the future of commerce, and it's exploring 21 new and different business models that are changing the face of the future. And frankly, what's happening, what you're describing, us turning into the product instead of the consumer, it's just one of those ways in which businesses are rapidly shifting, and these new models are coming into place in order for us to kind of build these entire new needs for products, right?
Yeah.
I mean, wearables and one example that I love to use is, in fashion, going back to talking about handbags again, in New York City, every woman has an it bag, an it handbag. It's kind of like a $2,000 bag or whatever it is that kind of gets you through the door and just shows that you're in or something. But you buy a bag and you have a bag one time. You have one bag and the bag is sold once. But if that bag has some kind of LEDs or e-ink or something like that, can kind of change it, or there's different fabrics that are starting to be able to change shape with pressure. As we're looking to the future, maybe someone buys a handbag once, but then they continue to subscribe to that handbag over time so they can always have the latest color or pattern or shape or whatever it is. Huh. And that is an entirely new business model for a fashion brand that's used to just pushing, what products one at a time.
Yeah, that's really pushing us into unexplored territory.
I love it.
As you think about wearables, it's like, a lot of the stuff that we're seeing right now is following kind of a phone or computer model where it's like, to the extent that they display data, it's for me, the wearer. But that's not really the way that we typically think about you know, clothing and accessories. It's like, you know, how, so there's an opportunity to think about, well, how can, what happens if we're wearing data, not just for my benefit, but for the people around me, as a statement, mm-hmm. in the same way that the way the clothes you choose is a statement of personality.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the tech wearable that we're seeing now appears to be almost a novelty. I feel like, and Liza, you made a good point about, you know, a handbag that charges your phones or that's a hotspot. That
right.
doesn't seem like a novelty to me. Do you guys think that you know, getting away from novelty and have something more functional like a hotspot is one of the keys to moving this forward?
Oh my gosh, yes. You've hit on something that is one of my biggest pet peeves, which is this idea of novelty. And Josh and I disagree about this a little bit. I do think novelty is important for us to kind of start figuring out what things can possibly do. But I think it's really important to move past novelty very quickly and get to the point where we're creating joy or we're creating utility. It has to be one of those things. And novelty and joy are not the same thing. And ideally, we can create both utility and joy at the same time. But novel, it's crazy what people call wearable tech these days. You know, I mean, it's like umbrella that changes color in the rain, or, you know, that kind of stuff where it's just like, that is not wearable tech. First of all, that kind of stuff has been around for a really long time, and people are just doing a little bit of headline grabbing, I think. But it has to actually have some kind of functional utility. And that's becoming increasingly important. And for the past few years, we've been releasing all these prototypes and calling them products. And that has to be done. We have to be done with that now. We're far enough along in this that we need to stop releasing prototypes, and we need to start releasing products that really do create that kind of utility that we need in our lives, such as charging our devices or, you know, mm-hmm. helping us stay connected.
I mean, I think that Liza mentioned that we disagree on stuff, and I think broadly we agree on that principle. I think that where
we disagree on some stuff.
Where we, well, okay, but
we're a married couple.
We're step away from the microphone for a moment. that I think that there's this important opportunity to sort of play and splash in puddles a little bit. And I think that designers, particularly interaction designers, can always learn a lot from toys and games. And that you can see some things that are like, you know, there's this thing called drum pants, for example, which is obviously not something that the world really needs. But the idea is that you put this little sensor, you clip it onto your pants, and then you can like tap out different rhythms or tap your foot. And basically your pants turn into a drum kit. And while that's sort of not exactly something, you know, we've got bigger problems to solve, right? I mean, we could be solving, you know, the water crisis instead of making drum pants. But that sort of first stage of thinking about, well, that's actually this really naturalistic interaction. This is something that we do all the time to sort of tap out a rhythm on your leg. That gets at this sort of thing of how do we start to think more about natural interactions that build off of what we're doing in the physical world and have a digital resonance. So while I agree that it's sort of, I think our end goal shouldn't be to make drum pants, I think that making them as an iterative step of experimentation, of sort of getting out of our head of how we solve serious interfaces, I think that can be actually really helpful as a step to solving those physical interfaces as a middle ground. So it's important to splash in puddles right now and play a little bit. There's just one last thing on that is Benedict Evans had this great line that I really like, and he was sort of observing the mouse, and how in the 80s every serious computer user was like, oh, nobody would use a mouse for that. That's not real computing. And of course that seems silly right now, right? But he has this line that says that you know, the future always looks like a toy to people who are overly comfortable with the past.
Snap.
Yeah, I think it's time to play a little bit.
That's great. I mean, it's all super interesting. You know, just to see. This is kind of one of the first big eras that I've lived through, that it started, and I'm actually seeing it grow and mature. So I'm really interested in seeing where it goes and how obtrusive it can get into my life.
That's sort of a forbidding statement.
Well, for those of you who are UX people who are listening to this, I think it's just really important to remember that your job is to shape behavior. And as we get into this really new territory, you know, really think hard about what behavior am I creating? Because, you know, as we create this sort of first generation, this foundation of interaction and experiences and what we do with all this data, it's we're the ones, the designers, the product people, who are going to really make these hard value decisions. And don't make bad ones. I mean, I think this is important. This is like a time to know your values and make some decisions and have a spine. can say no to bad and evil decisions, Uber, and you know, and to create companies that are good and positive and help us be more human.
Amen.
That's great. So when can we expect this book?
Oh man. Well, we're just at the outset. And writing a book together, we're still hoping that actually it doesn't ruin our young marriage before it even gets started. But I'm sure it's going to be.
I think in the spring.
In the spring. That's good. Well, we'll definitely look forward to it. And for our listeners, definitely keep an eye out for something like that. It seems really interesting stuff. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks.
But we don't want to take up your whole morning. So we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to sit down with us. So.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Such a treat.
Thank you. What's a good way for people, listeners, to get a hold of you if they want to bother you?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter, Liza K, LIZAK, and my fashion tech think tank is at Third Wave Fashion with a 3. And we actually just published the world's first print fashion tech magazine, so we're shipping that now. If people are interested in wearables in any way, I can't recommend it enough. I'm really proud of it. That's at thirdwavefashion.com.
And you can find my design agency, which specializes in connected devices and multi-device design, at Big Medium, at bigmedium.com. And I am Big Medium Josh on Twitter.
You can get us on Twitter at The Dirt Show, and please send your long-winded comments to thedirt@freshtoldsoil.com. Once again, I want to thank our guests, Liza and Josh, for coming on the show. This was great talking to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
So fun.
Thank you so much. Please review us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're listening to us now. We really appreciate it. It seems small, but it means quite a bit to us. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening, and we will try and do better next time.
Fame. Ooh, okay. That doesn't make any sense.